exercise my prerogative as moderator to ask the first question, and I would just like to ask this to the entire panel. Tell us if there is a difference and what is the nature of the difference of how a consumer disputes a transaction that is cleared and settled on their, a mobile transaction that's cleared and settled on their credit card, for example, versus one that might appear on their cell phone bill.
I can take that one. As for a credit card transaction, you have regulations. So if you find an unauthorized transaction on your credit card, you call the issuer or the issuing bank, and you make the report that an unauthorized transaction has occurred. And that investigation, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, has to be completed within 45 days. On the flip side, if you are doing a mobile payment and it's going directly to the wireless carrier, it all depends on the carrier's terms and conditions as to the amount of time that the investigation takes place. It's usually about 60 days, but you have to usually pay that disputed amount. Under the credit card, you don't have to pay back that amount, so that's the difference, the big difference, whether or not the consumer is out of cash while that disputed charge is being investigated.
I don't agree with that entirely, but I do somewhat. A lot of the mobile programs that I have seen, there is a bank, so there's an underlying payment network. There's often an association involved. And when you have, a Visa or MasterCard association, America's Best or Discover, they all have rules that set up timing. And by the way, they also do cover ATM transactions. So I've always... even in the prepaid card world, you will see that the regs in these associations cover those transactions too. They call it Reg E Lite instead of Reg E, but they still have their own processes in place to take care of consumers who have a problem. I have to admit that Bob, your example of when it goes not to back to a bank or to a banking program, but instead to the bill comes on your monthly, Verizon bill or whatever bill that you have, then I agree entirely with Michelle that really we'll look, at this point you're looking at the terms and conditions. Most of the telecoms that I've seen do have very clear rights for consumers to dispute their charges, and I've disputed plenty of those, lost cell phone, $500 of calls to Sri Lanka and have had it taken care of right away.
Okay, let's start over here.
Thanks. Judy, I have two questions for you related to state regulation, money mm-hmm. transmitter regulation. Twice you emphasized the point that they need to be holding dollar for dollar, but it was always my understanding that the bonding requirements A, vary state by state, and B, are not sufficient to cover. So in the case of the bill payment company a few years ago in New York that went belly up, leaving their consumers holding the bag. So I wanted to just push you on that to make sure I'm clear.
Can I go ahead and just answer that one?
Sure.
There's two things in the state money transfer licensing laws. They have bonding requirements, and then they have permissible investment requirements. And you are supposed to hold a dollar for dollar outstandings plus have the bond. And that New York incident, that was one where actually the regulator, when they were auditing, apparently missed the fact that they were not holding the one-for-one they were supposed to be. It is the typical rule in all of those.
I see. And then my other question is, as we move to increasingly virtual worlds, how do you think about state-level licensing, right? Most of the businesses that we're talking about here today are really national or international in scope. And so how do you deal with that tension?
That's a really good question, because the state money transmitter licensing laws do offer protection, but it is a source of frustration when they are across the states and not always uniform. If you want to do a national program, you've got to be licensed in 40 to 50 states. It's very difficult. There actually has been a suggestion that perhaps it's time for a national licensing law. I've seen it floated around as a way, rather than having to get a license on a state-by-state basis, to get one national license. And actually, I think that would be a pretty nice idea, but I don't know if it's going anywhere.
Okay, all the way in the back.
I'm Lauren Saunders with the National Consumer Law Center. It's working? Mm-hmm. Relating back to Jennifer's earlier comment about the unbanked and underbanked population, trust and confidence being obviously a key issue of bringing them into this space, as well as Judith's comment about a few bad apples spoiling it for everybody else. I'd just like to make some comments about a couple of areas, one, of course, being fees and how these services are paid for and the importance of the cost of the services, the honest cost of the services being charged in an upfront way that consumers see and realize and know ahead of time, rather than having us fighting after the fact about particularly abusive fees or payments. And a couple that I've seen in the prepaid space that to the extent they migrate over to mobile payments, I'd just like to point out, in addition to overdraft fees, I won't get into that, but you all know the debate there. Fees for checking a balance, even if it's tiny, even if it's 50 cents, it discourages somebody from responsible behavior. It can make somebody angry. Denied transaction fees or something similar. And so I just think it's really important that as this develops, everybody focus on upfront pricing. The second area is how people get information. And people who are doing mobile payments are in a middle ground between somebody who is totally outside of the computer world and gets paper statements and never uses a computer on the one hand, and on the other hand, somebody who does all their banking online and, has electronic statements and views their transaction activity. So these people are in the middle, and they've got this device. They can get some electronic information, but I don't think it's a substitute for either one of the two. And I'm curious what the panelists think in terms of, substituting the idea of reading terms and conditions on a cell phone, or even expecting that people can then go online later to see them. How do you get transaction information, statement information? I think, we can't substitute have everything in that cell phone. And there may still be a need for some sort of paper, either for the initial disclosures or statements if people, opt in for paper statements, for those who aren't able to do it in the electronic space. I don't know if you have comments on either of those topics.
Can I comment on that?
Sure.
And also comment on the other question before about the difference when you have a bank and when you don't have a bank. I want to talk, I'm sorry for talking about M-Pesa again, but I think it's a very illustrative case because it's a case where in a country with almost no regulation at all. There is no consumer protection regulation. There is no consumer protection law, no financial consumer protection regulation, very few rules about consumer protection. And you have a non-bank providing financial services, very basic financial services to 8.5 million people now. That's way more than the banks serve in that country. That's, I think it's more than double the number of bank accounts in that country, and it's going fine. It's going very fine, and people are extremely happy. There is no regulation for this non-bank to protect the clients, not even regulation saying that this provider should be liable for the services or for the agents, and the provider has been responding to consumer complaints and solving problems with consumers. So I think that example is very illustrative, and we should keep that in mind when talking about what kinds of protections we should provide to consumers. What is the point of reference? On the types of communications and if it's needed to have a paper-based communication, I think we have many types of models out there. some with paper-based. For example, when you have electronic wallet, mobile wallet, substituting cards. So you have a wallet of cards in your mobile phone. I've seen models out there that the client receives a monthly statement, just like a credit card. But for example, M-Pesa, clients do not receive anything, and we need to remember that we are still talking about very basic service, so it's payments. It's not checking accounts or anything very complex, not insurance. There is some examples out there, but it's very basic service that you can keep paper to a minimum.
Can I just make a comment? You know, it's great that it's been working in other countries because there aren't the services that they so desperately need. But, you know, we have a wide range of different kinds of services, and it's hard for consumers to know exactly what they're signing up for if they're not provided all of the information in a place that they can access readily and before they sign up. So, for instance, in the prepaid card space, there are so many different types of cards. How can a consumer, you know, really expect to assess which product will be best for them when all the fees are hidden? So it's quite important for consumers to be able to have that information front and center.
And just to add to that, I absolutely agree that I don't think that the mobile phone should take the place of paper. But perhaps the two can complement each other. As I said, I don't have confidence that terms and conditions will be read easily or at all on a mobile phone screen, but perhaps they can be sent on paper. And mobile phones can be part of the impetus to strip down some of these terms and conditions to something that's more readable, so you can have your paper statements or your paper terms and conditions, and then also that's something that's accessible on a mobile phone.
There's a lot of questions.
One of the questions that comes to mind is when we start thinking about electronic statements, privacy, and we start focusing on how can I get all this information on a small screen, I would challenge us as an industry, regulators, everybody involved, to the following. It's a paradigm shift. We shouldn't have to be burdened with 4-point fonts or pages. It should be more interactive. For me, at least, I remember 10 years ago when we, 12 years ago, when we were thinking, okay, how do we do the paper statement? Does that apply? Doesn't apply? And the reality is for the end consumers, 10 years after the fact, it's so much better to get an alert that tells them this is your balance right now, not what the balance may be at 30 days after the fact. Oh, because by the way, the statements are always behind. I'm very encouraged by the opportunity that this movement into payments for telecom operators goes, because quite frankly, who here knows what their phone bill is this instance? Most of us don't. And so to the extent that we start moving, and yet at the same time, most of us will know more or less what our balance is on our checking account. And so to the extent that we start moving there, this poses an opportunity. And I would more of a question to the panel and to anybody else out there. When you're thinking about how to make regulation fit, so for example, paper statements, privacy, whatnot, instead of just thinking, how do we make the existing standard fit onto the new technology, how do we leverage the technology? What are some of the thoughts that are coming about how to leverage the technology to make it better than the way it used to be? I don't know if there are any thoughts or ideas on that topic.
I just want to add that I agree that the difference for people with prepaid cards that have the text messaging, the alerts, so they never have overdrafts, so they know what they have. I mean, it's like it's a huge shift for them, and it is going to be very hard to kind of marry that concept with what we're used to. I'm used to the terms and conditions, and I agree that we're going to have to figure that out, but we can. Right. There's a couple people here who have questions.
Go ahead.
To go to your question, some of the regulations, particularly when it comes to privacy, were born out of a lack of consumer choices with what happened to their data. And we're seeing, especially in the online space and places like Facebook and most recently with Google Buzz, that consumers are increasingly asserting their privacy rights and demanding to have control, or at least privacy controls available to them, even if they don't use it. So if those controls are there and consumers have the ability to control what happens to their personal information, then perhaps the underlying reason why certain rules like CPNI or and even GLBA, where the privacy rules embedded in those laws and regulations, perhaps the underlying reason that they were put into existence in the first place will no longer be there.
This gentleman here.
Hi, I'm Mark Weiss with Fifth Third Bank. Just to speak to the privacy issue, I think that's the one that I struggle most with when you talk about the small economies that have proven out to be able to use these. The internet started out as a very small economy, and today we're in a constant battle of new attacks that are occurring. And I think that's one of the current concerns that we need to think about as we move forward, that we need to learn from what we learned from the internet as far as how much how many new types of attacks are going to occur, because that economy of scale goes up as more users are out there, the same way the internet did. There's more value to the folks who want to break into that and take that value away from the consumer and ultimately the bank because of zero liability. So just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Can I comment on something?
Please.
I can't remember the person who said that, but it someone said very recently, maybe Michael knows who it is, but worse than being exploited is not being exploited at all. So I don't want to sound with everything that I say here that we should go crazy and not have protections at all. I am myself a former bank regulator, and you know that, and I have my own fights, internal fights between protection and allowing those who do not have services today having the service. I just think I agree with everyone that protection is needed on all of those fronts, on data privacy, security. It's just this new world might require a change of paradigm from regulators and supervisors.
Paul?
Thank you, Bob. Paul Tomaszewski with the Secure Mobile Payment Council. This is a question for Michelle. And one of your slides confused me a little, and I just want to make sure that I'm getting it right. Normally, when I think of regulation in some industry or company that goes beyond that, that's a good thing. And when I see zero liability that goes beyond the regulatory requirement as a consumer, I see it as a good thing. Yet I thought the way that I understood the way you were presenting that slide, it was a bad thing for zero liability. Did I miss something there?
I was addressing mostly the prepaid card issue, it being just like a debit card, and a lot of people confuse it to be so. And yet, Reg E doesn't provide the protections as a debit card or a traditional debit card linked to a bank account. And so those cardholders are subject to only the zero liability policies that are extended by the networks, which are a good thing. But our argument is that prepaid cardholders should have the same Reg E protections as debit cardholders.
Okay, we have time for one last question. Gentleman over here.
Hi, Mike, I have a comment. I'd like to get a reaction to it. It's about, I'm a big fan of protecting consumers to the greatest extent possible. It seems to me one of our biggest obstacles has been that we're not clear sometimes, not as precise as we could be on the exact nature of the problem. Who's being victimized, by how much, in what way, where sometimes, in the case of one bank versus another bank or issuer versus another. So, the way it looks to us when we get annual very fresh databases, we'll see, for example, in the debit card issue, 2 years ago there were precisely two large banks representing more than half of all deposits that had zero liability provisions on debit cards that were not as good as credit cards, just two. Last year there was one, now there are zero. So if you bank at a large bank, you have a debit card, your protections are essentially zero liability policies. They're just as good as they are for a credit card. Can't speak to all the very smaller ones. And I don't happen to know the data on prepaid, so it's a very good point you bring up, worth investigating. My point is, then we'll see some of the, to add to that, some of the, I guess I'll just say, I don't know a better way to do it, some of it looks like political theater where you get like an identity theft day by somebody running for a particular political office on one side of the aisle or another, And to me, that does so much harm because it's really rare to see a factual perspective there. And so I'm just curious on a comment. Do you also agree that there's some harm being done to the actual real consumer if we don't take a very precise view of what the picture of damage looks like, so we prescribe something that actually matches up with where the real harm is, or do you see it differently somehow?
When you propose zero liability for cash, that's what it is. It's a prepaid instrument. Sorry.
Now I don't know which question to ask.
Yes.
I guess, well, I guess back to your question about whether or not we need to define what the harm is to the consumer in order to know what we're going to fix, I think that that's valid. I think that it would be useful. I think certain things like, you know, take Reggie on prepaid cards, which is a hot issue today. I could see I would want Reggie on, you know, my general purpose reloadable card, quite frankly, or my kids' university cards. But I don't want Reggie on a gift card if it's going to make my gift card, you know, not available or accessible. I mean, you have to, as you said, you have to define what the risk is. And consumers, I think, are really pretty smart. And they know what they want, and they will be able to let you know, this is a risk I can accept, this is a risk that I'm not going to accept. And it's very difficult to find that data. So one of those things that was useful to have the group like this here is to know that that people are looking at this and people are talking to consumers. I mean, we've heard, for example, that consumers don't want statements. A lot of them don't want statements, and there are better ways to get that data to them. But so you can't rely, as we heard before, on the old paradigms. Well, we always had statements before, so they surely want them now. You know, as I said, I mean, I'm trying to get my daughter just to carry her things and something besides the pocket on her blue jeans, and, you know, she won't have anything to do with it. So it's a shift, and we have to try to keep up with it.